And I might add that the scientific data shows us that at the North and South Pole in the past, there's been a subtropical climate. In fact, there's plenty of geological evidence that there's been subtropical climate all over the entire world. The only question we ran into was that the geological interpretation has been that it didn't all happen at the same time. But then we began to look at some of the data as to how these times were actually arrived at, and we saw that there were quite a few holes in them. Now, one thing I wanted to bring this up to point out to get our thinking clear again from last time is this. If about half, and I suggest to you that the Lord said he divided the waters, and let me just suggest that that could very well mean he put half the water down here to start with, and then later, he, in verse 9 of Genesis 1, he brought the land up out of the water that was around the earth. I believe that's what he did. And formed the continents. And actually, that about half the water was probably up in this layer. He said he divided it. And that could, that word could very easily mean he made an equal division. So that actually about, you see, for 40 days and 40 nights, the rain that fell came from this layer above our atmosphere that was protecting us and making our greenhouse. Now, let me ask you this. Well, let me propose this. If this is true, when it rained 40 days and 40 nights, and when the fountains of the great deep were broken up, what happened to all the water? When the earth was covered with water, where did the water go? Let me suggest very strongly that the early continent, as it was brought up, that there was much less sea in area. In fact, on our earth today, about 7/10 of the earth is covered by water. Only about 3/10 is covered by land. Let me suggest very strongly that at the beginning the seas were narrow, they were not nearly as large, and that the God began to move and spread the sea floor, just as the geophysical data seems to indicate today, that God spread the sea floor to accommodate the water. I mean, where'd all that water go? He had to make room for it. It fell from the sky, and it came up from the ground, trapped in the what the Lord called the fountains of the great deep. And so if you've ever seen pictures of the earth's seafloor, you'll see that it looks like it has spread. The only difference that I would suggest is that God spread it very, very fast in about a year. And that all we're seeing today is a slight what we call isostatic adjustment. In other words, the rebound is still going back and forth as God has spread things. And now, according to the natural law principles that God set up into effect, that it's equalizing itself now. So the point is that before this, I dare say that the mountains were not very high, that in fact that it was at the time of the flood that God did all the major mountain building that we have ever seen. All the distortion and contortion of the beds occurred at the time of the flood. You see, Mount Ararat today, where the ark landed, is 17,000 feet high, and the place where the ark appears to be, or may be there today, there's over 200 people that have seen it over the last, oh, I forget exactly how many years. But this being the case, it's sitting at about 14,000 feet high today. But you see, Mount Ararat is a volcano. It's not active today, but it has been in the past. And so there's actually no scientific way whatsoever to tell how high it was 1,000 years ago, or 2,000 years ago, or 4,000 years ago, or 5,000 years ago. Let me suggest it was nowhere near 17,000 feet high when the flood came. That God did all the mountain building and everything that we see, that the mountains that the Bible speaks of were what you would probably call a nice, good, strong hill today. And that all this tremendous volcano, see, when the fountains of the deep broke up, I suggest very strongly that tremendous volcanic action and much faulting and things like that took place. And that all erosion and things like that began with the curse. In other words, beloved, it hadn't rained until the flood. That's what Genesis says. Therefore, there was no erosion, and all the processes that we see going on geologically today were not in effect at that time. That's the point. That layer protected us, and we had no storms, no wind, no rain, no unequal heating. For our information, that if we actually tried to take the continents and fill up the ocean and begin to shovel, you know, all the dirt on the continents into the ocean to try and fill up the great trenches in the ocean, etc., that the surface of the earth would be covered by nearly 2 miles of water. And so there's plenty of water now. Number two, this layer, this water vapor canopy of transparent vapor, so that you could still get light in through it, actually invalidates all radioactive dating methods that try to go back beyond the flood approximately 5,000 years ago. In other words, the radioactive clocks are only any good since the last 5,000 years. Because, as we learned the last time, water vapor in the air, or carbon dioxide, or ozone, if it was ever just a few percentage points different from what it is right today, it will change drastically all the radioactive readings. And in fact, with this kind of layer, it would probably completely have retarded radioactive disintegration as we know it today, so that the clocks got turned on 5,000 years ago. All right? Do you understand what I'm getting at from that? And also, number three, from what we learned then, that God created a mature universe and a mature earth, and that everything that we needed, that man needed, was placed on the original earth. In other words, Adam showed up, not a baby, but a mature, grown man. This leads me into several of the things that I want to bring up tonight. The first thing that I would like to talk to you about tonight is that of population statistics. Population statistics. In other words, if in fact the earth, a man has been on this planet for at least 1 million years, then what would that mean statistically from a population standpoint? Well, let me just say this, that if man's been on this planet reproducing for 1 million years, we should have the most incredible population problem that has ever existed. I will demonstrate this for you so that you can follow along mathematically in a few moments. First, I'd like for you to consider God having to populate the earth in the first place. Why did we need a worldwide flood? Now, I brought my little handy-dandy 8-point digital calculator with me tonight. The Bible does not tell us how many children Adam and Eve had. It never mentions the number of girls, but it tells us that Adam and Eve had sons and daughters. Okay? The Bible does say that. Josephus, for example, says that Adam had 33 boys and 23 girls, and of course that's just hearsay and is not admissible evidence. But the point is, let's be blunt. Adam lived for about 930 years. There were no contraceptives in those days, and there was no television set. And so, what do you do? Let me suggest you reproduce. You have children. Let me just take a very simple mathematical example and show you. Did we actually need a worldwide flood? Why should we even suspect that we needed one? Well, let me suggest this for you. If you take the years in the Bible as literal, and if you add up the years from the time of Adam until the flood, you'll get 1,656 years. Now, suppose we started out with two people, a man and a woman, Adam and Eve, and they began to reproduce. Now, I'm going to be very generous. For 930 years, this man and this woman lived on this planet. Let's just suppose that in all that time, they had three boys and three girls. Now, that's not asking for much. My wife's grandparents only lived into their 80s, and they had nine. And they didn't have all that many years of being what we would call reproductive. But all the processes of these people were slowed down by this water vapor canopy. This is the method that God used. I mean, he could have used any method. This is the one that the data indicates that he actually used, that he protected them. Now, I'm going to be extremely generous. I'm going to start off with two people. And I'm going to let them have three boys and three girls, three mating pairs, Harold, okay? Now, to find out how many people that would generate in after each generation would be times however many generations we're going to get, to the nth power, 2 times 3 to the nth. Now, I'm going to be, listen, I'm trying to help the evolutionists out. And I'm going to be generous. Let's say that a generation is only 90 years. Now, that's pretty generous, okay? That's generous. Let's see how many people we can generate by the time of the flood, okay? If you divide 90 into 1656, you'll get 18 generations. So N becomes 18. In other words, beginning with two people having six children, three boys and three girls, three mating pairs, how many people would we generate in 18 generations? Do we need a worldwide flood? Okay? Now, let me say this. The value that I am about to get for you is a population increase of 1.5%. That is the rate of increase that this will calculate out to be. The present world population is increasing every year despite wars, disease, pestilence, famine at 2%. What I'm going to give you is 1.5%. It is actually today 2%. Okay? To do this, I flip and I'm going to multiply 3 to the 18th power. That's 3 times 3 is 9. That's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Went off scale. I have to push my little magic button that puts it back on. And there is the 18th generation, and I'm reading it here, and it's 3.87 times 10 to the 8th power, which simply means, right where that decimal is, I will write 3.87, and I will move this decimal 8 places. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, which is 387 million people, and that is half of the answer. 2 times that, you see, I haven't used my 2 yet. And so that would be about 700 million people that you can generate very easily at a population rate less than the population rate we have today. Now, how generous could I be? I only let them have children. A generation was every 90 years. Okay? Every 90 years. So that you can see very simply that, first of all, this is reasonable because today's rate is greater than this, but it's really not reasonable. I've probably given them way too much because the truth of the matter is, with that water canopy layer, they were not dying. There was no decay. Sin had not taken its full toll, and they were not nearly dying as fast as we are today. Now, let me say this about this number of 700 million, approximately, people. That is the number of people born in the 18th generation only. Now, many of their parents are alive that were born in the 17th generation, and grandparents in the 16th, and great-grandparents, and on. So really, the total population of the world, I would have needed to add several of these numbers up, and it's horrendous. It will come to be over 1 billion people. Therefore, beloved, it becomes very extremely apparent that we really needed a worldwide flood if we were going to actually destroy the life on this planet. Now, let me show you this. Just suppose Adam, bless his heart, let's just see, still being generous every 90 years to a generation, or let's be more realistic. Let me do it this time with 50 years to a generation. That's not bad. Okay, let's just see during Adam's last year how many kids, see he lived 930 years, so 50 into 930. Okay, to find out how many generations we'd have, well, what's that going to be, about 18? Well, I'll show you here. 1 to 5 is 50, 93, that's 43, 8 to there's 45, so it's roughly 18 generations. Excuse me, 40. So it's roughly 18 generations. Now the point is, How many great 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 grandchildren during the last generation of Adam's life would he have to go around and kiss and welcome into the world? Well, you can see immediately that it's the exact same number I just started with. I mean, that's the potential of these population statistics. It's the same. Now, if you want to be over generous again with these guys, let's give them 90 years to the generation, that still gives us 10 generations. Let's just calculate that out, just for fun. All right. Here we go. 3 times 3 is 9. That's the square, cubed, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I got 60,000, and that's half the answer. So 120,000 if a generation was 90 years. Now, let's just be a, let me just show you how really wild it can go. Just suppose they'd had 10 kids. I mean, that's not unreasonable. Many of your grandparents and great-grandparents had 10 children. That would give you 5 mating pairs. Let's see what that gives you at the 10th generation. Okay, still using 90 years to the generation. 5 times 5. That's squared. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. 9,765,000. Roughly. And that's only half the answer. I've got to multiply by 2. That is how many potential... And this is completely feasible. The first one I started off with was only 1.5%, which is less than today's. Okay? Okay. I think you got that. So there's no problem populating the earth before a flood. That's the point. We needed a worldwide flood. Suppose we started out with 2 people. The current population of the earth today is 3.5 billion people. Now that's 3.5 times 10 to the 9th. That's the current, roughly, the current population of the earth today. Suppose you started out with 2 people, and their average family size was 2.46 children. Now, the actual average family of today is 3.6. Worldwide, the average family today has 3.6 children. I'm starting out with 2.46. How many years would it take for 2 people having 2.5 children? Okay? Not 3, but more than 2. On an average, how long would it take for 2 people reproducing at, watch this, not at 2%, which is the current increase of the population today, but at only 0.5% growth per year? In other words, I'm using a fourth less than the actual population growth is today, despite wars, pestilence, famine, and disease. Fair enough? Fair enough. I'm going along with them that maybe there was more disease in these days, though that's not true. I mean, you know, that medicine's better today than it was. That's not true, but I'll just go along with them. I'm being generous. How long would it take 2 people to reproduce at 0.5% growth per year to make 3.5 billion people? Beloved, the answer is 4,000 years. In other words, if Adam and Eve had lived 4,000 years ago and they began to reproduce and increase at only 0.5% per year, we would now have today's population. On the other hand, if the evolutionary model is correct, and we've had people on this planet for approximately, and incidentally, this is 40 years to the generation, okay, which is really about what we've got today. This one that I just calculated for you. 40 years to the generation, 0.5%. That's very realistic. On the other hand, if the evolutionary model is correct, and really man is at least 1 million years old, then at 40 years per generation, 40 into 1 million is 225,000 generations, okay? Then we've had people reproducing for 25,000 generations, okay? If they increased at only 0.5%, not at the 2% the world's going today, at only 0.5%, if you began with 2 people, Mr. and Mrs. Zinjanthropus, or Mr. and Mrs., you know, Australopithecus, whoever, Robustus, how many people would be on this planet right now at 0.5%? The answer is 10 to the 2,100 power. Now, we learned last time that we don't even understand 10 to the 9th, which is a billion, separate entities. Let me try and give you some understanding of what that means. The mathematical odds of you living the next second is 10 to the 10th power to 1 that you will live the next second. Now, everybody made it. Now, that shows you somewhat mathematical odds. There's only calculated in the whole known universe 10 to the 80th electrons. Do you understand what 2,100 power is, that means a 1 with 2,100 zeros after it. That's how many people ought to be here now, at 0.5%. Now, I might add that if you jam the entire known universe with electrons, you know what electrons are, these little teenies? It would take only 10 to the 130th power to fill it up. Have you got the point? 10 to the 2,100th power means that if there were that many people on this planet today, we would extend out shoulder to shoulder, head on head, foot on foot, all the way to the moon, in every direction, past our sun, past our solar system, past our galaxy, and completely past the known universe of nothing but people. That's how big that number is. Where are they? Okay? Now, that's number one. Number two, be generous. Be generous, okay? Let's go back and give them the benefit of the doubt. Completely, Mike. Completely. Let's go back 1 million years ago and let the population increase somehow, though they can come up with all kinds of secondary guesses, somehow so that reproducing for 1 million years or 25,000 generations, somehow we end up with today's population. Don't ask me how. Beloved, that still means that there would have been, it's 10 to the 12th, I believe, yep, 3,000 billion people would have lived and died on this planet in the last 1 million years. 3,000 billion people. That is 3 times 10 to the 12th power. Question. Where in the world are their remains? I mean, this earth should be one continual bone graveyard. Now, it's true, very true, that a fossil is extremely rare. To become a fossil, you must be buried almost instantly upon death, or your burial and your death be concomitant. But the truth of the matter is that even their cultural materials, such as pots, pieces of clay, tools, weapons, we should find them by the thousands and thousands and thousands, and yea, millions and billions, if in fact there had been 3,000 billions of people. Do you understand what I'm saying tonight? In other words, we're looking at reasons why what's trying to be put upon us as science simply isn't holding up as really being such hot science. I might add, if the flood account in the book of Genesis is only talking about, or was supposed to only talk about, a local flood, then God really lied, didn't he? Because it says he put a rainbow in the sky, and he said, as long as that rainbow is in the sky, I'll never do what I just did. And now, I don't know about you, but I've seen a lot of rainbows, therefore that promise is supposed to still be in effect. And I have read the paper many times, and there's been a lot of local floods that kill people. If God was only talking about a local flood, then he lied, because there's been thousands of local floods since the Genesis account. And you can understand that the rainbow would have been quite a miracle for those people, because as long as there was that vapor canopy around the earth, there would have been no rain, hence no rainbow. Can you imagine what a tremendous shock that a rainbow would be to someone who had never seen it? Now then, the next thing that I want to mention to you tonight is there any scientific evidence that the earth is really not old, that the earth is actually young? Yes. As we discussed last week, carbon-14 is not in equilibrium. The carbon-14, you remember we learned that the carbon-14 to carbon-12 ratio is not in equilibrium. That means it's not in steady state, which Dr. Libby in 1945 assumed that it had to be, even though his instruments said that they weren't, because the answer didn't come out what the evolutionists believed to be true. Actually, his data said that carbon-14 was building up in the upper atmosphere 25% faster than it was radioactively decaying down here at the surface. Now, we know that it takes approximately 30,000 years to 40,000 years at the outside for an equilibrium to be reached Beloved, the point is, since carbon-14 is not in steady state, the Earth cannot be 30,000 years old, or it would be in steady state. That's the point. So, this carbon-14 that everyone is trying to tell you is proving great ages, along with uranium-238 and all the other methods that I talked to you about last time, actually says, no, it isn't. That's number one. Number two, I'm only going to give a few. I might add that I have a book here that lists 80 scientific measurements, devices of using time, things that we can use to time things with, like the evolutionists use the uranium method. Or, remember, we learned how fast the salt went to the sea. You can also measure how fast other things go to the sea. And you can measure, say, for instance, how fast the meteoric dust is falling into the Earth. If you project how fast it's falling into the Earth's atmosphere right now, and the Earth was anywhere near as old as they say, well, we should have about 265 feet of meteoric dust of nothing but iron and nickel all over the Earth, and we'd be buried alive. We couldn't even stand it. Just... You may remember they were afraid that was what was going to happen to the astronauts when they went to the moon. But they found no such layer. So the point is, though, that this book has over 80 different scientific devices that can be used to measure the age of the Earth, which all give answers in the thousands of years, not billions and not millions. So the whole point is, it just really depends on which pieces of scientific data you want to believe and which ones you want to ignore. And as we learned last time, the greatest percentage of all radioactive datings of rocks are totally ignored because they give the wrong answer. They don't give the answer that evolution says it should give, and so they're thrown out as erroneous. How did they know? And we learned that last time. Now, there is one tremendous thing that we can use that's very helpful in helping us to know actually how old the Earth may be, what the limit is. And it's the decay of the Earth's magnetic field. Now, the Earth has, as you know, a north and south magnetic pole. The radioactive dating methods that I have been discussing have only been measured for approximately the past 30 years. Dr. Barnes at the University of El Paso, a physicist, has been studying and measuring the rate of decay of the Earth's magnetic field. We have discovered in science that the Earth's magnetic field is decaying exponentially. Now, it has been measured for the past 135 years. The half-life of the Earth's magnetic field is approximately, and I'll draw a half-life drawing up here, 1,400 years. Now, compare that to carbon-14, which is 5,730 years, or to the uranium U-238 method, which is 4.5 billion years. Now, remember, this means that we believe these things have been consistent, absolutely consistent, for 4.5 billion years, kicking off particles at a steady rate. We learned last time that no matter what any textbook tells you, the truth of the matter is that all radioactive disintegration are statistical averages, and that to really say that they have always radioactively disintegrated at that exact rate is like looking at a 70-year-old man for 5 seconds and trying to tell you his life history. It is totally guesswork. Now, the most accurate half-life you could use would obviously be the shortest, and the one that you had observed the longest period of time. In other words, the Earth's magnetic field has been decaying that we have been studying for 135 years, and it's got a half-life of 1,400 years. That would be much more likely to be correct than something you have studied for 30 years and measured and observed for only 30 years, which has a half-life of 5,730. Or for 30 years when it's supposed to have a half-life of 4.5 billion. See, in other words, 30 out of 4.5 billion is nothing practically. But 135 out of 1,400 years is much more accurate. Okay, I think you can see that. Plus the fact that the magnetic field of the Earth is a worldwide measurement as compared to these radiocarbon and uranium methods, which only apply to local little areas, a local rock or a local fossil. So something that measures uniform over a world would tend to be much more scientifically accurate than something that measures in a 5-mile area or a 2-mile area. Okay? So what? Well, now what does this half-life mean? It means after 1,400 years, half of the magnetic field of the Earth would be half as strong as it had been 1,400 years before that. And then 1,400 years later, and then 1,400 years later, and 1,400 years later. Now looking backwards, let's see. One, two, three, four, I want to do it five times. This means that the Earth's pull right now is 32 times, I'm going to say it backwards, 32 times less, okay, than it would have been 5 times 1,400. This is five times. I've made five half-lives. 1,400 times five is 7,000 years ago. In other words, beloved, 7,000 years ago, the Earth's magnetic field would have been 32 times greater than it is now. Now, let me just tell you what that means in simple everyday language. That means the Earth's magnetic field would be as strong as that of a magnetic star. Now, magnetic stars can maintain that kind of field because they have thermonuclear processes. That's a fancy word for saying like atomic bombing type explosions, okay, that maintain that magnetic field. But the Earth doesn't have anything like that. In fact, the Earth's magnetic field is due to circulating currents, most likely. This is the best scientific thing we've got going, that in the iron nickel core of the Earth, there are circulating currents that are free circulating electrical currents in the Earth's iron core. And currents, electrical currents, have to have a resistance to flow against. And resistance causes, come on girls, you have irons, heat. And so as this heat, as these currents flow against the resistance, heat is generated and the heat has to be dissipated into the outer medium from the center. And the point is that is why the Earth is losing its decay. Its magnetic field is decaying. It is losing heat from the center. Okay? And it's doing so exponentially. In other words, exponential. Well, I don't want to go into that. You do know what an exponent is, though. Look, you just didn't know you did. There's 10 to the first, 10 to the second, 10 to the third. These are exponents. 10 to the fourth. In other words, 10 to the first is 10. There's 100, 1,000. And so on. Okay, so you can see 10,000, it's going up. That's called an exponential curve. Boy, they really go up fast. 7,000 years ago, it would have been too hot with all that heat dissipating for human life or any other kind of life that we know to have existed on this planet. Plus, the magnetic pull would have been incredible. Now, this is actually the most scientific piece of data that we have, and it sets an outside limit of between 7 and 10,000 years. I'm giving it 10,000 now, just in case someone wants to quibble. I'm going to be generous about the 1,400-year half-life since we've only really been observing it for 135 years. But a scientist wouldn't even give you that. And I am a scientist, incidentally, for those of you that may be visiting tonight. And so, beloved, there are tremendous numbers of scientific data that indicate the Earth is extremely, very, very young. Now, two things need to be focused on very strongly. First of all, the vapor canopy, by its absorbing action, would affect all carbon-14 dating methods drastically. Why? Well, remember, how did we make carbon-14? Cosmic radiation comes in, strikes our atmosphere, causing it to ionize. As it does, some neutrons are produced, and these neutrons collide with nitrogen-14, kicking out a proton, and therefore lowering the atomic number from 7 to 6, but maintaining the same weight, since neutrons and protons weigh about the same. That converts it into carbon-14, C6, with a weight of 14. Well, if there was a huge water vapor canopy up there, many, many, many millions and millions, and yea, billions and billions of water molecules, these water molecules, this canopy layer, would slow down the cosmic radiation, which primary cosmic radiation mainly consists about two-thirds of just high-speed protons. And as they, of course, there's also some helium nuclei and some others, but about two-thirds of them are high-speed protons. This would slow them down as they come through the water molecules, and so that when they actually would strike
the nitrogen 14, they would not have enough energy left to kick out the proton from the nucleus and convert it into carbon 14. So that would lower the cosmic ray incidence, and there would be less carbon 14 being formed in the atmosphere. In other words, most carbon 14 that was formed in the atmosphere probably was not formed till after the flood. Therefore, the carbon 14 techniques are very questionable before the flood. The second thing that's absolutely important that you see is that there is also a shielding effect by the magnetic field, which would produce a similar result. The magnetic field of the Earth provides a shield against these high-velocity particles that could cause great damage to living organisms. If that field would go down essentially to zero, there would be no protection against these high-velocity particles for little organisms here on the Earth. Now, the evidence that we've presented on Dr. Barnes' work that the magnetic field of the Earth is rapidly decaying exponentially is of absolutely crucial importance to the carbon-14 dating technique, don't you see? But because the magnetic field strength of the Earth varies significantly in the past, and as it did, it would affect the influx of the cosmic radiation. The magnetic field would tend to form a barrier against these high-speed protons and helium nuclei, which have positive charges, and would tend to channel what radiation that would reach the Earth down to the polar regions. If the field were much stronger in the past, then it would be certain that the influx of the cosmic radiation has been less than today. And in turn, that would mean that the production of neutrons in the atmosphere would have been less in the past. And it would further mean that collisions of these neutrons with nitrogen atoms would have been fewer in number, and the production of carbon-14 in the past would have been much less than it is today. The same general principle of the water vapor principle that we just mentioned. Slowing the particles down so that there would be no collision and no significant kinetic energy from the collision to kick out the protons in the nuclei. Point then, what was the nitrogen 14 content in the atmosphere in the past? No one really knows. Now again, the decay rate of carbon 14 may have been different in the past. It's assumed, as we've mentioned, that all these decay rates are constants. But for example, experiments on iron 57 has shown that its decay rate changed by as much as 3% in the when it was using electric fields. Well, if the electric field of the Earth was different significantly in the past, then who knows what that did to the decay rates. In fact, recently a Dr. Anderson did some experiments and published on it, and he said that the decay rates were not as predictable as previously believed, and that they did not occur in the pattern that classical theory assumes. And his findings were confirmed by an independent research group at the Atomic Energy Commission. Now, there's another phenomenon I should mention in relation to this, that because so many of you here have a scientific technical background, and others that will be listening to the tapes will have a background for that. They'll try and say, well, actually, the orthodox position and explanation on the source of the Earth's magnetic field is a history of magnetic reversals. In other words, that the Earth's magnetic field has reversed itself many times. This is a highly touted hypothesis, and along with that comes the hypothesis of a dynamo source within the core of the Earth. Now, they talk about the so-called history of magnetic reversals, which is supposed to prove that the Earth's magnetic field is billions of years old. But I need to tell you that the data that upon which this is based, that is, observed orientations of remnant magnetism in the rocks, is incredibly contradictory. You see, in 1883, Sir Horace Lamb proved theoretically, using Maxwell's equations, that the Earth's magnetic field could be due to an original event, which he, in other words, creation, and from that time it's been decaying ever since. Now, that, of course, has had a thwarting influence on evolutionary bias. You see, for the Earth to be very, very old, billions of years old, there's only one way the Earth's field could have continued, and it has to have some sort of dynamo or electrical power generator in the core of the Earth to keep it going. But in every case, the dynamo theory has always come out to be inadequate and untenable, no matter what they've tried. And it's supposed to be related to some hypothetical movements of fluid in the core of the Earth. In other words, any long age theory is going to have a dynamo to keep going. But if you'll just read, if you ever look into the text and begin to read, they just have nothing but problem after problem. That there's really no satisfactory theory of a power source to drive the dynamo. To make it worse, a fellow named Cowling mathematically proved that it's just not possible for fluid motions to generate a magnetic field that has an axial symmetry. such as, for example, the dipole field of the Earth. And that was quite a blow to the evolutionary efforts to keep some sort of dynamo theory going. As of now, there is no physical evidence, seismic or otherwise, that there is any motion within the Earth's core. And yet there's going to have to be some sort of motion to have a dynamo. And Cowling's work proved that no such motion can be a simple or symmetric motion. Of course, Lamb's work, which showed that the decay rate and predicted the decay rate was going to be exponential, carries along with it a consequence that the decay of the Earth's magnetic field has led us to an increasing amount of radiation reaching the Earth. And so this increased cosmic radiation reaching our atmosphere increases the carbon-14 production rate, as we mentioned. And in turn, that cosmic rays produce neutrons, which collide with nitrogen and produce carbon-14. Now, the carbon-14 production rate, therefore, is greater now than in the past. And the importance of that, as we've said, is the carbon-14 dating has been based on the assumption that the production rate is constant. But we see it isn't constant. The fact is that the production rate was less in the past than in the present. See, that alters the previously computed carbon-14 dates, revising them to a very young age. And that correction is progressively greater for the older dates because of the exponential character of the decay. So the real old dates really shorten up a lot because it's exponential in nature. So the only alternative to a young age for the Earth's magnetic field is to deny the existence of a decay of the Earth's magnetic field. And hence they've come up with this idea of the reversed polarity. So despite the evidence of decay of the Earth's magnetic field and the consequent conclusion that the field is young, the traditionalist evolutionist ignores these data, and he goes on to substitute some reversed hypothesis in order to retain his geological age chronology. And he assumes that the Earth's magnetic field is reversed many times for unknown reasons, and he simply does not use the actual data on the magnetic field of the Earth, but instead he reads local remnant magnetization in the rocks, attempting to make his case on the basis of the orientation of this magnetization. The reversal hypothesis stays in trouble because the data on magnetization in the rocks gives no conclusive evidence of reversals in the field. They've come up with these four physiochemical processes that are said to cause self-reversals. I mean, these processes are supposed to be unrelated to the Earth's magnetic field, and they're needed by the traditionalists in order to make the data that doesn't conform fit their hypotheses. The actual scientific fact is that all of the real-time data and the evaluations of the Earth's magnetic moment support the decay theory, which leads to a young age. I think the most single pertinent fact is simply this. Sir Horace Lamb's solution, using Maxwell's equations, has the incredible advantage of predicting the decay rate, which we have actually confirmed by more than 130 years of real-time measurements. His work, the scientific data, has verified.